Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
I mean, why didn't they just use Harry Holt's high school nickname, Puss? These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
Search The Dead Can't Sue podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A dejected ex-lover or a helpful hand around the house? Who was Timothy Loosemore to Marie Vermont? This question was central to his murder trial. I'm Stephen Stockwell. This is episode 2 of the case of the Airbnb guest.
Mr. Loosemore was a farm stay guest at the home in Goldie near Kilmore.
We didn't really expect to have something dangerous happen.
The prosecution alleges the 62-year-old from the UK killed Miss Vermont and lit a house fire to cover it up.
She was a very kind and caring person, and we're very proud of who she was and how she brought us up.
This hand-built house was a labour of love. It's all been lost, alongside everything she owned and, her sons say, evidence of her final moments.
After the Stonehouse fire, police thought Timothy Loosemore smelt of petrol. And in this episode, we're going to find out what the arson investigator discovered at the house and what Marie's friends and family thought of this lingering house guest. To help us unpack it all, we're joined by Anna McGuinness, an ABC reporter in Bendigo. Anna, welcome back to The Case Of.
Thanks, Tocky.
The relationship between Marie Vermont and Timothy Loosemore is a key part of this story. Was he happy in the arrangement at the house, or was he someone who, you know, was kind of annoyed and frustrated with where this relationship was going? What evidence did the court hear about that?
So during the trial, there was a number of witnesses who had spent time with Marie in the kind of months leading up to and while Timothy Loosemore was staying with her. Many of those were friends that she'd met through this camping group called Rolling Solo, and they seem to be going on trips like every month or every couple of months. So they kind of have this running record of how things evolve throughout the start of that year.
Yeah, the friends from Rolling Solo seem like really interesting people. And the way that we kind of hear about that group and Marie through them is like all these different kind of lenses as they're giving evidence in the court. And I mean, she really seemed to bond with them, and maybe she joined them kind of after separating from her husband. What's this kind of group like?
Yeah, so we hear from one of the group members, Jenny Lafoe, who says it's a women's only group. You can be any sort of relationship status over 18. You can bring your dogs, but strictly no men. So sorry, Stocky, you can't join them. But we hear that they're kind of travelling around to different caravan parks across Victoria. They're the first one's around February, and then there's a month later. So they're travelling around. They're having their happy hour each afternoon where they're recalling these chats that they're having with Marie and hearing about, I guess, how things evolve.
Yeah, and the kind of the conversation, yeah, sort of evolves over time. So you've got kind of part one, she separated from her husband, and then part two, she's thinking of starting an Airbnb, right?
Yeah, so around the start of 2023, around February, they're chatting about her Airbnb, and they hear that she's got this boarder coming to stay, this man, and it sounds like it's quite a lighthearted conversation, and it gets to the point where they're kind of sitting in a circle, it's happy hour, and they're stirring her up, and they're like, we know you've separated a few years ago, maybe it's time to blow the cobwebs out, maybe you should sleep with him. And Jenny Lafoe says she remembers this specifically because one of the older women in the group was kind of disgusted by this kind of crass way they were talking. But you can kind of imagine a group of friends just egging each other on, stirring each other up.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. And I guess because this continues, you know, Marie continues to go on these trips. What's the update the group gets after this time at the next trip?
Yeah, so about a month or two later, they're on another trip at another caravan park. And she says, yep, I have slept with him. It's been this one-off thing. She kind of announces to the group. But what we hear from Jenny Lafoe is that Marie kind of says, yeah, we've slept together, but I don't need to do it again. I don't want a relationship, and I'm sort of happy to leave it there.
Okay, right. And, you know, that's Jenny Lefeu. There's other friends as well. And these friends sort of, you know, these are people that she's met through this Rolling Solo group, this women's only camping group. But the friendships aren't kind of exclusive to just these camping trips. Because there's another woman, Rosalie Watson, who actually, you know, is good enough friends with Marie that she's going to birthday parties and visits their house as well. Is it in May that she goes and stays?
Yeah, late May, Rosalie Watson stays the night at the Stone House. She was actually one of the friends that Marie had spoken about doing Airbnb because she'd done it herself. So Marie said, come check out the room. I've set up for Airbnb, stay the night. And Rosalie describes a kind of awkward night at the Stone House. When she arrives, she doesn't know that Timothy Loosemore's going to be there. And the arrangement is that Rosalie sleeps in the Airbnb room while Timothy Loosemore's on a mattress in Marie's room so that she can kind of experience this Airbnb situation.
Right.
And we hear that that night they're kind of chatting after dinner, and there's this discussion where Timothy Loosemore starts talking about the fact that he wants a relationship with Marie. He says he's getting attached to her. And Rosalie says Marie doesn't really engage in the conversation, doesn't seem like she wants to talk about it. She puts on some music and they start dancing, and Rosalie decides it's time to go to bed.
Okay, right. What happens the next morning? Because is Rosalie staying a couple of days or one night? Like, what's the arrangement here?
So the next morning, Rosalie tells the court that Marie wakes her up and kind of tells her that she needs to leave. They've got stuff they need to do. And Rosalie is a bit taken aback by this. She didn't understand that Marie would, you know, kind of be kicking her out so early in the morning. And she's kind of like, well, can we have a cup of coffee? Can we just have a chat? Because she's noticing that Marie's not quite herself. So they end up going for a walk around the dam. And that's when Rosalie says that Marie tells her that Timothy Loosemore was kind of crying during the night about this situation and saying that he wants this relationship. And so Marie kind of seems a bit thrown off by all that the next morning.
Right. Okay. And so they're, yeah, kind of having this conversation the following morning at this house. And just to give us an idea of the timeline, Anna, so we are, at the moment, this is kind of late May. The fire is early August. Is that right?
That's right. So it's just a few months before.
Anna, how close does it sound like Marie Vermont and Timothy Loosemore were?
So one of the parts that stood out to me to kind of indicate that was the fact that they'd been to a hot springs. So after that night that we hear about from Rosalie, a few months later, it's Timothy Loosemore's birthday. And we hear that in June, Marie and Timothy Loosemore go down to a hot springs together for a little trip away to celebrate his birthday down on the Mornington Peninsula.
Right. So just the two of them going away on this trip?
That's right, a birthday trip. So my reading of that is that it seems like they're getting along and are relatively close at that point.
Right, okay. So we have these kind of different versions of the relationship. And, you know, in that conversation with the Rolling Solo group, Marie does kind of talk to them more about the fact that, you know, look, she's happy with Tim being there, but really she does want to get him out. And is she giving them kind of like an idea of a deadline? Is it this kind of conversation that she kind of wants him gone maybe by sort of October, maybe a bit earlier? What are the conversations she's having with that Rolling Solo group?
So the friends say, some of them say that Marie's brought up this kind of August, late August deadline because one of her younger sons is going to be moving back onto the property and she kind of wants to make space for him. And so she's told Timothy Loosemore he kind of needs to be gone by around the 20th of August.
Okay, right, great. That's useful to know as well. I mean, one of the things we've spoken about already in this series, Anna, is that, you know, the prosecution line is that, you know, Timothy Loosemore wanted a relationship with Marie Vermont and she didn't want one with him, and, you know, that's led to her murder and this fire. But the defence line is that, no, look, this relationship is different to the way that it's being presented by the prosecution. You know, Marie Vermont was happy having Timothy Loosemore around the house. You know, what sort of questions were they asking these folks about, you know, the relationship and Timothy Loosemore?
So interestingly, the defence doesn't really question the friends on this account of what they say Marie has told them about Timothy Loosemore over these months. What they actually question them about is kind of about her mood, and they ask, did you know that she was taking antidepressants? Had she ever mentioned that she had depression or was feeling suicidal? And they all kind of say no to all those questions, that they didn't kind of get that sense and hadn't been told any of that.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. I mean, it's, yeah, often, I mean, the evidence is the answer that the witness gives, but, you know, the questions often give you an insight into kind of where the defence is going with a line. So interesting, yeah, where they've kind of picked up on that and the questions they're asking around, yeah, depression, antidepressants, all of that. And we know that Marie was very close with her son, Darcy. He was always going to be kind of key witness because he was at the house with both Timothy Loosemore and Marie Vermont the week before the fire. He left the day before it happened. What did he say about this relationship?
So Darcy says he and his mum were pretty close and they kind of talked about their feelings and seemed to be quite open. He says that Marie Vermont, his mum, really liked her independence and was liking feeling, I guess, like she was on her own and she was doing well since the relationship with her ex-husband had ended. Mm. Darcy says that Marie has made it clear that she doesn't want a relationship, but she feels like Timothy Loosemore just keeps pushing her for more.
Yeah, and I mean, we've talked a little bit about this message that Marie Vermont has sent her son, Darcy, kind of in the week before the fire. And in that message, she says, look, I've made it clear to Tim that I don't want a relationship and he's not doing well. Can you keep an eye on him? And Darcy, is that when Darcy heads up to the property after that message?
So Darcy's nearby working when he gets that message. And he says he rings his mum straight away. He's kind of seems to be a bit concerned about what's in the message, gives her a call and they kind of chat about it. And then he heads back after work. And his sense is that Marie tells him that Timothy Loosemore is packing his bags and is going to be heading off and heading somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So he is kind of surprised that throughout that week that he stays there at the Stone House, that Timothy Loosemore isn't leaving, is just kind of hanging around because he's impression from his mum was that when that text message was sent that things were kind of wrapping up and Timothy Loosemore was going to be on his way.
Anna, there's all these different kind of versions of when Timothy Loosemore is supposed to leave Marie Vermont's property and her house. You know, we have, as we talk about these kind of different relationships that are being described by the various parties in this trial, but, you know, there's kind of like several different points. You know, there's one version we hear from a friend is that, you know, he's got to leave after while she's away on a trip to Vietnam and Cambodia. And then there's another version where he has to leave, you know, after she returns from a trip to Tasmania to visit one of her sons. Like, where do we land on that? What sort of conversations are had and what was the plan?
So the defence really does try to question this timeline of, well, when was this deadline that they say Marie had given Timothy Loosemore to leave the Stone House? And the questioning, one of those lines of questioning is to Darcy and, well, who was going to look after the property while Marie was in Tasmania? She had an upcoming trip to visit her son. She had a later trip to Vietnam and Cambodia. So they're kind of pointing to the fact that Timothy Loosemore has been here for months. He's been looking after the property. So it doesn't make sense that he would be asked to leave before she has these trips coming up. And Darcy does say that at some stage the plan was for Timothy Loosemore to stay behind while Marie's in Tasmania and look after the property. But he's adamant that that plan has changed. And in fact, he says the property doesn't need someone there 24/7. He tells the court that they've got friendly neighbours. His sons aren't too far away. It's not critical that Timothy Loosemore is around while Marie goes travelling.
Okay, great. Thanks, Anna. I mean, you know, that's kind of one angle of the defence questioning Darcy. What else about Darcy's evidence kind of pricked up your ears? Because I know we were talking in that first episode about the petrol containers around the house.
Yeah, so Darcy talks about coming back to the property after the fire. It's kind of a day or two later, he's allowed to have a walk around in the company of police. And he says he walks into his tool shed and immediately notices that this 20-litre fuel container is missing. He also notices two other containers missing from the side of the house. He says were his mum's. They were quite new, so he knows what they looked like. And he's looking everywhere and he just says he can't really find them anywhere.
Yeah. The thing I found really interesting about the way that Darcy talked to the court about these fuel containers was that his mum had some that she liked to use for her purposes and these were the nice good ones. And then Darcy had these kind of like old kind of crappy cracked ones and he was not allowed to use Marie's jerry cans for anything like that. So he had this like quite specific memory about what was where. But when he was questioned by defence, they kind of managed to bring up or this other reason kind of emerged for what might have happened to these jerry cans, right?
Yeah, so there's a fair bit of questioning from the defence about the fuel containers. As you said, how does he know which ones are missing? Mm. And he goes into all these specifics. Well, this one had a cracked nozzle, this one was new, so he can kind of tell the difference. But it's brought up that when he gets back to the property, he notices that some work's been done on the roadside at the front of the property. It's been mowed. There were some tree branches that have been cleared. And they kind of press him on, well, would that have been a fairly big job that, say, would have required the mower to be filled up or the car to be filled up? Kind of going to this point that maybe there was a use of these fuel containers and the fuel in them during that time that he was away.
So what's the timeline on this, Anna?
So Darcy says he's definitely checked the fuel containers full before he leaves on the Friday. He says it's his job to kind of keep an eye on the machinery around the property. So he's checked the fuel containers. He's made sure they're full. He leaves on the Friday. And then when he gets back to the property after the fire, he can see that there's been work done. This walking track at the front of the property has been mowed. That wasn't like that before he left. So the defence is suggesting that before the fire and after Darcy's left, someone at the Stone House has mowed this walking track.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because there's sort of this allusion in the prosecution opening that maybe there's some sort of accelerant used in this fire. And that's why, you know, we have the mention of the fuel containers in the opening. But then you hear this kind of conversation between Darcy and the defence that, again, kind of questions the timing of all of that. I mean, Anna, this is really a story that's centred around a fire at the Stone House. You know, you've seen the video of what it looks like afterwards. What sort of state was it in?
So we see a video that's taken by the crime scene officer, and the way I would describe it, it just looks like a building that has been totally gutted by fire. It's blackened. Aside from the stones, all the timber is charred and blackened. There's charcoal ash all over the floor. There's really no kind of furniture left. It doesn't really look like a house anymore. It's just the shell of it with, I guess all this charcoal and ash just building up from that really intense fire.
Yeah. Could you see Marie Vermont's body?
Yes. Yeah, so in the living room, the crime scene officer who's filming kind of lingers on this spot. And at the start, I wasn't really sure what I was looking at, to be honest, because just the level of damage and from that fire, I don't have a good recollection to be able to describe what I saw, because I think it was kind of so confronting that it's not really something I kept, you know, front of mind, that visual. Mm. So can't really tell from looking initially, but just the way that the camera lingers, you realise what we're sort of looking at.
Yeah. You know, we've heard from the pathologist in this trial about the kind of state of Marie Vermont's body. What did we hear from them about, how it was and a potential cause of death?
So the pathologist says that it is really severely burnt and he was unable to determine a cause of death from Marie's remains, what was left for him to assess. He says it's also not possible to determine if there'd been any injuries to Marie before she died. There's also no carbon soot in her airways, no carbon monoxide in her blood, which he says raises the possibility that she was already dead before the fire started.
Right. Okay. How did the defence question this pathologist? Because obviously, you know, there's a question around cause of death. You know, you can't tell how she has died, but, you know, what questions are they asking to sort of unpack that further?
So the defence goes into the presence of an antidepressant medication that was found in the toxicology and a possible side effect of that, which can lead to cardiac arrhythmia. But the pathologist says it's relatively uncommon to rare, and it's actually a diagnosis of exclusion, which means he would have to rule out every other possibility before he got to it. And he also says on the antidepressant medication that if it was such a high risk, this side effect, then they would have taken this drug off the market. So it kind of sounds like he's saying, yes, there's this side effect, but in this case, he's not saying that it's, you know, a likely cause of death.
Yeah, okay, right. It was interesting in the re-examination I found, you know, we know there's no injuries to Marie Vermont's body, but in the re-examination, so you have your, you know, evidence in chief, cross-examination, and then prosecution, if there's anything they want to clarify, they kind of jump back in afterwards. Just asking the pathologist whether or not Marie Vermont had any broken bones, which is probably really the only thing they could tell, and they just sort of say, no broken bones, but really outside of that, no way that they could tell kind of what state her body was in. Because again, this fire was just so hot and so intense. You know, what did we hear about where it started in the house?
So we heard from fire investigator John Kelleher, and he says, in his opinion, it started in the living room. The damage there is the worst compared to other rooms. So he's saying the pattern of fire is it started in the living room and then spread either side out to the kitchen and to the other end of the house.
Right, okay. Not in the fireplace?
No, so we know that there's an open fireplace in the living room. There's also a wood heater with a pizza oven above it.
Mm.
And he says he can rule out the open fireplace. There was actually firewood being stored in there that was only partially burnt, wasn't completely incinerated.
Mm.
There was also a wheelbarrow in front of it overturned that had also partially burnt wood in it. We've also heard from Darcy, the son, that they didn't really use that fireplace often and preferred to use the wood heaters. And the fire investigator says he's looked at the wood heater and there's no issues he can see with it either.
Okay, right. I mean, something that we've talked a lot about so far in this series is, you know, the missing petrol canisters, the smell of petrol on Timothy Loosemore that the police identified when he was taken to hospital. I mean, did John Kelleher get into whether or not petrol was used? Could he tell in this fire?
So he says the severity of the damage from the fire does raise the possibility that an accelerant was used. And he does find on a small piece of mat that's left in the living room floor, he says he finds components of petrol, but it's not enough for him to actually confirm whether petrol was used. There's also, he says, a mark on the concrete floor near Marie's body that he says kind of raises his eyebrows a little bit. It's about the size of a square or rectangular container. And he does have the thought that maybe that could have been a plastic fuel container, but there's also the possibility it could have been just any other plastic container rather than one that was carrying an accelerant.
Yeah, right. So the fire's just like so intense, it's just kind of destroyed all sorts of potential evidence that may have existed in that space. There was something interesting I noticed early in the trial was one of the investigators, a crime scene investigator, talking about kind of how she'd gone around the scene. I think it was the woman who was actually filming the space as well, pointing out that, you know, John Kelleher had actually been through the space a bit before her and kind of been in that scene. I mean, was there anything else that John Kelleher found?
So John says that as he's going through, he says that there's like 20 to 30 centimetres of ash and charcoal that he's using a shovel to kind of dig through and find, you know, he's looking for a cause of this fire.
Mm.
But he also finds three kitchen knives in the living room. And this is something that obviously catches his eye.
Mm.
And we see photos of them and they're shown to the jury. I guess your typical kitchen knife, the blade is shown to be around 20 centimetres,
mm-hmm.
and there's three of them found in different spots around the living room.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. Obviously, hard to tell, as we've talked about, what has happened to Marie Vermont's body in that sense as well, because she's so badly burnt. I mean, you know, with John Kelleher, though, I mean, I can't imagine the defence is particularly keen to have the idea that, you know, an accelerant has been used around the house during the fire. How did they challenge John Kelleher? What questions were they asking him to try and tease out more detail?
So when they went to the evidence about this, the components of petrol found on this piece of mat in the living room, the defence asked him about what, I guess, other liquids could have caused those components to be found. And one of the suggestions the defence puts is that perhaps a solvent or a paint thinner could have been on a table and spilled onto the mat. And that makes a connection for me because we've heard earlier in evidence about work that's been done on a staircase, a wooden staircase that's been recently sanded back and oiled. So it seems like the defence is making a bit of a connection there.
Mm-hmm.
They also ask about other explanations for the severity of the fire. And the fire investigator says, yes, it could have been multiple ignition points can also lead to that kind of intense fire. Or just the fact that it could have been burning for a long time before the firefighters arrived and managed to start putting water on it.
Yeah, right. Okay. Did they get into the knives at all, the defence?
There was extensive questioning about the knives to the fire investigator from the defence. It was kind of this exhaustive back and forth about the exact location of the knives in the living room, the possibility that maybe the fire investigator or police might have moved them while they were sifting through the charcoal. And the fire investigator says, yeah, look, it might have moved a little bit, but we're pretty careful when we're doing this process. And there's also the suggestion that perhaps if a fire hose was from the firefighters was directly aimed at these kitchen knives in the kitchen, could they have been, I guess, sprayed into other directions into the house? And Kelleher just maintains it's extremely unlikely, and that in all his experience, more than 30 years experience in house fires, he's never seen knives being able to travel so far. And he also says if that were the case, perhaps there also would have been other kitchen items that made their way into the living room.
Yeah, right. Okay, got it. I mean, we've talked a lot about Timothy Loosemore smelling like petrol in the ambulance in the hospital, the police sort of saying, look, you smell like petrol. Was there any conversation around how that may have occurred?
So the defence asked the fire investigator about how he found the clothes, how they came to him, and he says that they're all individually packaged. But the defence says, well, actually, did you know that they'd been bundled together in a bag at the hospital? So the paramedics had removed Loosemore's clothing to check out whether he had any injuries, and his clothes had been kind of bundled together. And the defence also puts that if maybe one of the items in that bag of clothing, like a shoe, was wet and maybe the petrol could have transferred to other dry items in the bag. But the fire investigator sums up by saying he's found moderately evaporated petrol on all items in that bag and says, well, yes, it's possible. What he found just wasn't consistent with that.
And Anna, I have a vague memory as well, talking about Timothy Loosemore's clothes and that record of petrol, evaporated petrol that was found on them, that there was some questioning about whether or not that could have occurred if they had been doing that garden work earlier that day, that if he'd been on the mower and being around the property cleaning things up. Is that right?
Yes, so we've heard from Darcy that there's been some work done at the front of the property with that mowing and tree branches moved. And the defence does question him on, would that be a lot of work? Would that require maybe refilling of the mower or refilling of the car? And Darcy says, well, the car, if it was filled, they would take it to a petrol station in town. They wouldn't have filled it up just out of jerry cans. But he does say, yeah, it is possible that the ride or mower may have needed more fuel.
Yeah, okay, got it. Anna, thank you so much for joining us for this episode. You know, we've got kind of parts of Timothy Loosemore's story in here, but in our next episode, I'm really keen to dive into the body-worn footage from the police at the hospital where we hear from Timothy Loosemore what unfolded that night, what he was doing, where he was going, and how his story that he was going out to get some firewood matches up to what we've heard here and what was found at the scene as well, especially with a lot of firewood sitting next to this fire unburnt. We'll also get into the closings and ultimately the verdict, Anna. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode.
Thanks, Stocky.
We'll be back in your feed on Tuesday. If you want to keep track of the case of, make sure you grab ABC Listen. And if you want to navigate through all of the different series that we've got, you can also jump onto the ABC Listen website. There is this wonderful little series tracker that's up there, so you can go through and follow all of the different variations of the case of. It's very much worth having a look at if you get lost. Be back in your feed on Tuesday. The case of the Airbnb guest is reported by Anna McGuinness and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. A big thank you to senior lawyer, our legal queen, Jasmine Sims, for her legal advice, to the Bendigo Newsroom, and also to Audio Studios boss, Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Dja Dja Wurrung and Wurundjeri people.